Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 12:59 PM, that is Pacific Standard Time. Today is February 28th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Well, we've had an incredibly momentous week, and there has been a slew of days where the market has pulled back by 2 and 3 and 4%. So we haven't seen the kind of declines like this in the course of the decade-long bull market that Wall Street has enjoyed. And we are already down about 10%, and the market has just begun to show the very faintest signs of support coming through. I do think that considering the size of the oversold condition that has replaced the overbought condition and the proximity of the Nasdaq in particular from in the region of its trend mean, that we're due a bounce. But the chances are that we're going to retest the low at some point over the intervening period between now and, say, the middle of April. When we look at the consistency of the trend on the NASDAQ over the last decade, then it has had the ranges one above another. Each of the ranges has been relatively lengthy. There was one in 2011, another in 2012. They both lasted about a year. Then there was another that lasted approximately 2 years, 2015 and 16. There was a quite lengthy range between 2018 and then into 2019. The market ranged a little bit higher. But then we had this incredibly emphatic breakout. The pace of the advance in the breakout from the lows in October of last year was the fastest pace of advance we'd seen in the context of the decade-long advance bull market. So there was some evidence of a little acceleration coming through. And now we've had a very violent pullback. So this is, by definition, a massive reaction against the prevailing trend. And we did have some evidence of acceleration. Now, of course, the index does not quite reflect the extent of the acceleration that we had in some of the most speculative of shares. Tesla, for example, had got all the way up to test the $1,000 level and then has pulled back by approximately $300 in this course of just 2 weeks. There is the clear potential that it is going to be a while before it can sustain a move above 1,000, and that there is likely to be a significant period of ranging, similar to the kinds of ranging that it has put in previously. The big question people are asking is the reaction we're seeing in the stock market going to represent a lead indicator for a recession? I think that's by far the most important question. It is worth remembering that the stock market itself is a lead indicator for recessions. And while it is, I think, important to look at the NASDAQ 100, it's equally important to look at the S&P 500. The NASDAQ has been the totem for the technology-driven bull market that we've had over the last decade. And certainly the pace of the advance we've seen in the top five largest companies in the world has been one of the primary factors in the NASDAQ's outperformance. The S&P 500 is a much broader measure, and it pulled back very violently in here this week. It is now back below the trend mean. And I think it is now appropriate to say, well, we have a failed upside break. This is the first time that we've had a failed upside break in the course of the decade-long advance. So this is a significant trend inconsistency. This is not something that is going to be erased overnight, and it has had a deleterious effect on sentiment. So that alone is something we need to pay attention to. I think at this point it is really very important to appraise ourselves of what the consistency characteristics for the S&P 500 over the last decade have been. We have three 18-month to two-year ranges. Each of those ranges had a consolidation in the region of the previous peak and then broke out. Each one of those breakouts was sustained until this week, and those breakouts had generally lasted for anything up to 2 years, and this one has lasted approximately 5 months. So we have a shorter breakout, although it was a steeper breakout, and the breakout has not been sustained. Now, the bigger, I think, there is then the longer term consideration, that when we look at the S&P 500 on a longer term basis, or look at it with a longer term moving average, the 1,000-day moving average has been an area of support on repeated occasions over the course of the last decade. It was equally important during the previous bull market, and particularly in the early phase of that bull market, it offered support. When we start to go further back to the bull market leading up and out of the Great Depression, then the 1,000-day moving average also represented an area of support. So I did put in the figures here. In order to get down to the 200-day moving average, it was a decline of 11%. To get down to the 1,000-day moving average, it would have been a decline of 22%. And we have certainly gone through the 200-day moving average and about halfway down to the region of the 1,000-day moving average. Well, what there is the potential here for is some steadying. The big question is whether the market is capable of pushing back above the trend mean. And if it can, well, then we can say that it was an inconsistency, that there was an exogenous factor because of the fear about the coronavirus. But of course, that would be contingent on the fears abating. And so far, we do not have the good news that the pace of spread in the virus has peaked outside of China. Now, I think it is very much open to question whether we can conclude that the figures coming out of China have got any kind of credibility. But what it does increasingly look like is that they have given up on containment. And that, I think, is the most important factor, that they have made the determination that the risk from the coronavirus is most acute if they persist in containment. And instead, they would rather take the loss in terms of productive capacity, or the loss of life, but which is likely to be concentrated in either the sickest of people or in the elderly. And that, unfortunately, is something that they are willing to countenance because it's a command economy. In fact, if one were to simply look at the statistics, China has got a very high dependency ratio because as a vestige of the one-child policy. So they've been trying to correct that by encouraging additional births. Something I did write about earlier on in the week was that we might look back on the coronavirus in a year and refer to it more as the euthanasia virus than anything else, because it is the median age of people dying is in the order of 75 years. And they don't linger either. Once the symptoms become apparent, people are dead within 2 weeks. So that's incredibly efficient in terms of knocking out the elderly population. But what it also means is that elderly people in the rest of the world need to be particularly vigilant and to be, I think, progressively more alert to the need to wash hands, to be very careful about transmission, and just simply look after one another. Well, we are likely to see a clear low in the markets evolve when the rate of spread of the virus internationally peaks. We're not there yet. So that does suggest that a lot of bad news has been priced in a short period of time on the stock market. And now the big question is, what happens next? So the stock market is one of the primary lead indicators for the global economy. High yield spreads are also an important lead indicator for recessions, and they have popped on the upside. So it's generally speaking around when the high yield spread is surging through 500 basis points that we get a knock-on effect for the stock market. I would hazard that it is the other way around on this occasion, that we've had the impact in the stock market and that is influencing the high yield market. It was the 500 basis point level was the key level back in 2007. And it was also an area of support for the market back in 2011 and in 2016 when the market started to bottom and yields and high yield spreads started to come back down. So we're at a point where certainly there is some risk being priced into the high yield market. But I think that if we're looking at, well, where in the high yield market is the risk most acutely evident, it's in the energy sector. And high yield energy spreads are surging higher. And at over 800 basis points right now, this is a significant move. Well, the reality is that oil prices are trending downwards, and we're down an additional $2 in here today. In terms of Brent crude, that has taken the price down to approximately $50. When we look at the chart for West Texas Intermediate, then we're right down on the lows that have been posted over the course of the last approximately 4 years. So that $40 area is going to be an important point where some big questions are going to be asked about the energy sector. Considering the spike in high yield spreads we're seeing today in the energy sector, it suggests that there is going to be a significant number of bankruptcies in the wider energy sector. Now, something that I have not heard a lot of commentary about over the course of the last while has been the dry powder in the private equity sector. Now, this is a chart from back in October, but it does highlight the fact that at the end of 2018, which is a year and a half ago, private equity had $2 trillion in dry powder waiting for an opportunity. There is the very clear potential that bankruptcies in the most highly levered portion of the energy sector are going to result in some bargain basement pricing, and that private equity firms are going to swoop in, or that we're going to get a significant trend of consolidation within the sector. Now, when we then go ahead and look at what's been happening, for example, with ExxonMobil, then the acceleration in the trend is really quite apparent. It's gone from 70 to 50 in a very short period of time. Now, they've never cut their dividend. And I think when you see a share like that trading at 6.84%, then this is a rather extraordinary set of circumstances. I think the other point, of course, is that it's very much considered that the risk is in the shares, because the bond rating is still AA+. And if we look at one of their more liquid bonds, which has a maturity out to 2049, then the yield there is still only 2.93%. So what bond investors are concluding is that, yes, there is some risk in Exxon, but that it's very unlikely to default. Equity investors are pricing it as if the company is going to go bust, and you can't have it both ways. So there is obviously a mismatch going on in here. And when we then think about Royal Dutch Shell, they have a similar business model. They've both concentrated on natural gas. and Royal Dutch Shell has pulled back from 2,200 to 1,600 in the space of about 4 weeks, which is an incredible acceleration on the downside. Now, we do not yet have evidence that oil prices have bottomed, so there is still potential for additional weakness. But the reality is that oil prices are not going to zero. And the price where we are right now with oil is already really very oversold. And it is likely to contribute to consolidation and to at least a temporary slowing of drilling. And that will reduce the overall supply situation. Even against a background where we are moving into a slower economic environment internationally, then oil prices are rapidly getting down to levels that are completely uneconomic for the vast majority of producers. It's going to create bankruptcies, but it's unlikely that it's going to be the majors go bankrupt. It's going to be the smaller wildcatting producers, or the deep water producers, or the bitumen producers up in the Alberta region. So I do think that the kind of moves that we're getting today in the energy sector are creating the kind of value opportunities that value investors really wanted to see at the beginning of the year, but I think weren't really apparent. The kind of move that we're seeing in energy sectors generally is really quite acute. Now, this massive decline in the energy sector, which has taken the broader S&P sector all the way back down to the lows put in 2008, is a really very significant move. Then when we look at the renewables sector, well, it did pull back in here today, but not by nearly to the same extent that we've seen in other sectors. And I think this is particularly relevant. In an environment where there is a clear move towards zero interest rates, and that is not alone in terms of Europe or Japan, but rather that there is a clear move towards zero interest rates and an increasingly large number of bonds with negative yields, then investing in highly speculative ventures is something that has the potential to create value. One thing that we definitely know, it's also something that Warren Buffett was talking about in his shareholder letter, was they've been involved in the utilities sector in Iowa for a number of decades now, and they've continually invested in new infrastructure. That has allowed them to grow the business, and they can offer a substantially lower price for electricity than their competitors. When we think about the utilities sector, it is generally known as a sector that provides dividends. And it is generally considered to be defensive, but it pulled back extraordinarily violently in here this week. Well, when we look at the index, it has a dividend yield of approximately 3%. And the question that investors are probably starting to ask right now is, considering the age and condition of infrastructure, not only in the USA, but for example, in Italy, we had Atlantia and their exposure to the autostrada network of toll roads, where roads are collapsing because they were never designed to take the volume of traffic that are currently transiting them. We have bridges that are falling over. We have flood risk in a number of countries, drought risk, fire risk, the bankruptcy of PG&E in California because of their old infrastructure sparking wildfires is another example. These are not, I think, isolated incidences in terms of these pieces of infrastructure, but rather they're symptoms of a wider problem, that there is a lot of infrastructure that investors have been relying upon to take dividends from for decades, that on an individual day-to-day basis do not represent special risk, but they do have special event risk when those pieces of infrastructure eventually collapse. So we've definitely seen evidence of that over the course of the last couple of months. Now, when we think about what does that do, it's obviously creating a market in alternatives, not only because of the continued advances that we're seeing in technological innovation, in the demand for renewables because of the climate hysteria, but it's also because investment in infrastructure is completely necessary. So now there is a market in what kind of investment is going to be best. And that is, I think, the primary reason why we're getting this movement into renewables. There is both a push and a pull element to it. And the reality of lower interest rates for longer and free money is something that is going to enhance speculative interest. Because of the risk, there is likely to be a higher potential reward as a result, and the competition for those kinds of assets where there is the scope for a significant advance and also the potential for yield, that is a factor that is likely to drive the green environmental bubble. The relative strength that the green sector, the renewable sector, is exhibiting right now is a standout. It's a particular standout when we see that almost everything has been selling off in here this week. Well, what this is giving us evidence of is that it is the green sector is where money is sticky, even in an environment where everything else is selling off. Now, obviously, when we look at contagion selling, and we have plenty of evidence of contagion selling, the fact that gold was down in here today $65, it's more than unwound half of its overextension relative to the trend mean just by moving or pulling back in here today. The fact that gold shares posted an extraordinarily large downside weekly key reversal, that's also evidence of contagion selling. There is no reason why gold should be pulling back other than the fact that people have profits in gold. And when the stock market pulls back in such a violent manner over the course of a week, then people seek to plug holes in their portfolio and they start to sell. We can certainly see why gold should be one of the first to recover. Hong Kong has now introduced helicopter money. They're giving HK$10,000 to every permanent resident. They're giving $80,000 to every owner of a tourist business and $200,000 to every owner of a restaurant. So that is aimed at stimulating the economy and assisting businesses in meeting their payroll. China has pretty much given up on allowing companies to default. So they have rolled back all of the financial reforms that were introduced over the course of the last 4 years. That means that if we're looking for a clear reason for why China's market has been somewhat steadier, well, that's probably it. But nonetheless, it's very unlikely we're going to see China breaking on the upside. China remains the epicenter of risk here, and it is going to take a significant amount of time for them to get back into peak production. That is putting a lot of downward pressure on the industrial resources sector. But even so, copper prices have continued to hold the $2.50 area. And again, this is another example of relative strength coming in, and it is bouncing off the $2.50 area in here today. When we think about the London Metals Index, well, it hasn't been quite so strong, and it broke down 4 weeks ago, and it is still on its lows. If we go back and think about, well, what is the recession risk? So high yield spreads are rising, but they're not at alarming levels. The stock market has pulled back, and there's a lot of panic and evidence of contagion selling. There is a clear assumption that we're going to see additional interest rate cuts. And that, I think, is going to be one of the clearest determining factors on whether we do, in fact, get a recession or not. 10-year yields have pulled back in a violent manner, and this is a very impressive rally in terms of the government bond prices. We are at a new all-time low in terms of the 10-year yield. So I think I need to update this chart. This is a resumption of the bear market, and there is the clear potential that we're going to see additional downside. I don't know why that's not well, we know what it's doing on the weekly chart. We can simply zoom out. The reality is that the bond yield got all the way up to 3% at the beginning of 2019. Then it failed. It has come all the way back down to test the lower side of the range. It bounced to unwind the overextension relative to the trend mean, and now it has broken on the downside. I did find, I saved this chart from, it's really quite a while ago now, perhaps 6 months. It's the number of developed countries where the percentage of countries with long-term yields below that of the USA. And as recently as October of 2019, it was all of them. And the number of occasions when that has occurred previously has been before recessions. So it is an indicator that we have got a situation where we're late in the cycle. And I do think that's one of the more important points. Then if we look at where the risks are, I do believe that China represents the epicenter of risk. But then we also have the distorting influence of extraordinary monetary policy and very low interest rates, which did create a bubbly environment in venture. Now, venture capital is exactly the kind of bull market environment that the green sector is now starting to benefit from. It's exactly the same rationale. If you have very low interest rates, then even if 9 out of 10 investments in ventures go bust, the potential for outsized gains in the 10th could absolve the loss from the other 9. And there is the potential that some would be really great success stories. And that rationale spurred a massive bull market in venture, which clearly accelerated in 2017 and 18, all the way up to the peak in 2019, and it has since halved. So it does suggest that the bull market in venture has pretty much ended. The number of companies that are coming for IPO continues to increase, so we know that we are late in the cycle. Now, the more important point is, what is the likely response going to be? Because all of the German government bond yield curve is in negative territory. The 10-year yield is at 1.16%. It was over 3% a year ago. And the trajectory is still downwards. So that is putting downward pressure on interest rate expectations. The market is currently pricing in the potential that we could see 4 interest rate cuts in the USA this year. Now, I think the most important thing to monitor about the yield curve spread is that it is a lead indicator when the yield curve spread becomes inverted, but it becomes an urgent indicator when the spread is surging through 50 basis points. The yield curve spread is currently at 23.8 basis points, and it did rally over the course of the last week. Then, when we look at the alternative yield curve, we have, and I just want to make sure that this is the right one. We have the yield curve becoming inverted for a brief moment back in September. Then we had the not as clear a lead indicator back in 1998. It did not invert on the 3 month and 30 year. Now, one thing that I think is important to highlight is the Federal Reserve looks at the difference between the 3 month and the 30 year. I think the market has more often looked at the difference between the 10 year and the 2 year. I think it is important, though, to pay attention to the fact that when we look at the. I do need to put up a bond to get in there. So when we look at the yield curve spread for US 10-year treasuries, it is certainly inverted where the short end of the curve is higher than all bonds out to about 3 years, but it's got a belly in the curve so that the 2 year is not inverted relative to the 10-year and the 5 year is not inverted relative to the 30-year. If we look instead at the Canadian sovereign yield curve, we get a better example of what an inverted yield curve looks like. It's inverted all the way out to 7 years. So we certainly have these bellies in the curve. In order to get an upward sloping yield curve, then we're going to have to see interest rates fall aggressively. And that, I think, is what is likely at this stage. If we were to see the yield curve spread surging up and through the 50 basis points level, then the potential for a recession would be really quite acute. And that is something that we do need to be alert to. Now, one thing that is, I think, also important is that we can't have a recession without people losing their jobs. So when we look for the when we look at jobs, for example, the jobs plentiful situation has been one of the things to pay attention to, and it has certainly started to encounter resistance. So that would suggest that the potential is we're going to see some contraction in the number of jobs being available. It's quite likely that we're going to see the potential, at least, for the number of available jobs to contract from here. When we look at the number of, and I just want to make sure I've got the name correct, it's the number of job openings. It has already pulled back by more than it has done in the last 10 years. Well, I think logically, people or companies stop hiring before they start firing. So when we then think about the jobless or the number of jobless claims, and just putting that on a 4 week moving average, it's last been updated for the 21st of February. We're going to get another update next week. if this were to break on the upside and start to trend higher, then that would be a very clear indication we are moving into a recessionary environment. Now, I think that we don't have evidence of that just yet. And there isn't, when we look at the kinds of indicators that we have available to us, what we can say is we're late in the cycle. I don't think there is any denying that. We know that the global economy has experienced a slowdown as a result of the trade war, and now the coronavirus represents a wild card. The infection rate of the coronavirus is something that is likely to create a pandemic. The mortality rate, which is anything up to 20 times higher than the flu, the seasonal flu, is something that's likely to continue to stoke fear. The knock-on effect of a slowdown in consumer spending and the cancelling of conferences, the cancelling of vacations, the cancelling potentially of school, people looking to work from home rather than commuting to work, that's also going to hit the restaurant sector. So these, I think, are some of the most important facts. We have not yet seen a significant contraction in consumer activity in the USA. Obviously, anywhere that has got a surging number of cases definitely does tend to have a knock-on effect. But for example, Darden Restaurants is, well, it was up 300% off the lows in 2014, and this is a massive reaction against the prevailing trend. We've had unrequiting selling, but there are obviously some sectors that have deserved the selling and some which have arguably been sold aggressively for no other reason than the fact that we've had contagion. Netflix, for example, should be a net beneficiary from people going out less and staying at home and watching TV more. So it has been a stalwart over the course of the last week. If people are working more from home, then companies like Microsoft should be doing better as well. They're certainly going to be spending more time on their phones, so Apple has bounced from above its trend mean. When we think about Google, certainly people will spend more time on their computers, and the share has bounced from the upper side of its range. When we then think about Amazon, well, Amazon could potentially be more impacted because of the damage to its supply lines, but certainly people will likely spend more time ordering online than going to supermarkets if they're worried about contagion, so that should be beneficial. Then when we think about, well, what about the biggest losers? Well, if Amazon does well, then supermarkets are probably going to take a hit. Then we have the cruise lines, and Carnival Cruises has been trending downwards for 3 years already, and it's now accelerating lower. But it was off its lows in here today. We've had an extraordinarily deep pullback, so I think that it is more likely than not that we're going to see a rebound coming through in here. The next Federal Reserve meeting is going to be on March 17th, and I think the market is going to be waiting with bated breath to find out exactly what they have planned. I believe it is quite likely we are moving increasingly towards extraordinarily low interest rates. Now, the important point here is that in terms of speculative assets, the return that an investor can get from stocks and the yield they can get on stocks over bonds is back at lows we haven't seen in years. So the last time we were down at these lows was in 2016, but every time it gets down to about 60 basis points, then we do start to get some evidence of a favoring of equities over bonds, and that will be particularly relevant for the risk parity strategies. We're down now at 87 basis points, and we haven't seen levels like this in quite some time. So we could yet get down to the yield premium for equities over bonds seen in 2008. It's certainly a possibility. That was 100 basis points of yield in equities over bonds. Now, that's an incredibly impressive pickup in terms of the equity premium that's available. It's just not something that we see all that often. And every other time we've got down to these levels, it has been a very significant buying opportunity. It's been a buying opportunity because of the flood of liquidity that has helped to stoke asset prices. So as long as that remains the case, then it's quite likely that what we are being presented with right now is in fact a buying opportunity in the equity market. I'd rather think that we're likely to continue to see the larger cap shares doing better because they have got the weighted average cost of capital very much in their favor. We're likely to see the continued outperformance of the renewable sector for the reasons I've discussed already. The continued massive accommodative monetary and fiscal situation that we have is likely to stoke renewed interest in gold. But it's also likely to be beneficial to the global economy. Now, we're not yet at the end of this coronavirus scare, and there's the potential it's going to get worse before it gets better. Obviously, the reason why this equity yield differential has gone so wildly in favor of equities is because of the slowdown and because investors are starting to price in the potential that earnings are going to be worse than they had been anticipating at the beginning of 2020. We may get a recession, and that may result in some companies having to cut their dividends, and then that would affect this spread as well. But we're not quite there yet in terms of the recession risk, and the potential for central bank activity to lend further assistance to this liquidity-fueled environment, I think, is still a credible potential. But that is, of course, contingent on consumer sentiment remaining reasonably robust. And the jury is still a little out on that. But the price action and the accelerations that we've seen are evidence enough that we've had a significant amount of selling already. Now, let's consider what would a top look like if we were, in fact, to get one. The failed upside break on the S&P 500 is an inconsistency, and there is absolutely no denying that. So, that, I think, is something that we need to pay attention to. Now, it was off its lows in here today, and if we see it bouncing back above the trend mean next week, then that would probably be the most benign of all scenarios. Considering we know what the consistency characteristics are of the move, then the easy way to conclude, well, what's it going to look like when it ends, would be that it sustains the move below the 200-day moving average. Then it breaks down and sustains a move below the 1,000-day moving average. the longer it ranges between the 200-day and the 1,000-day moving average, then the more stops will be introduced and the greater the risk will be. So I think that's something that we do need to pay attention to. It is obviously what a top formation completion would eventually look like. But we're very early. In fact, the big pullback we've seen has just about unwound the advance we put in since the breakout. We still have the other 10 years of advances on which investors are still resting. So we've definitely had a pullback. The risk of a much more volatile environment over the medium term rather than the short term is non-trivial. But in the short term, there is the clear potential that the VIX index has probably peaked. It got all the way up to, got above the 50 area in here today. And it is pulling back from that level as we come to the close on Friday. It is worth reminding ourselves that today is the 28th of February, so it is the last day of the month. It's when portfolios tend to be rebalanced. It's when some pension fund and life insurance money start premiums start to come into the market. So it creates a natural bid under prices. Now, if that can persist into next week, then that is likely to be beneficial. Peaks in the VIX index are generally much better indicators of lows in the stock market than lows are of peaks. So the fact that 50 has been an area of resistance in 2018, 15, 11, and 10, all of which represented good buying opportunities in the stock market, is important. We've had a very meaningful pullback. The market was overextended relative to the trend mean. That has now been almost completely unwound. There has been contagion selling, so there is now the potential that we're going to see significant bounces coming through. I personally think that the gold market is way oversold, particularly in terms of the gold shares, and that this is representing a new buying opportunity. I think the outperformance of the green sector is a complete standout. Then, of course, we have the technology sector, most particularly software versus hardware. The obvious potential is that supply chains are going to remain under pressure, that the Chinese economy is going to continue to experience pressures, but they are involved in an enormous stimulus package right now. They are rolling back just about every financial reform that they've put in over the last 5 or 6 years. And that is going to stimulate activity. It's quite likely to stimulate a lot of speculative activity, and most particularly in the housing markets. But they're not worried about that right now. What they really need to do is to get people back to work, and they're willing to do whatever it takes. That pretty much means that the renminbi is going to continue to weaken from here, and it is closing out the week around the 7 area, and also testing the region of the trend mean. The dollar index has been pricing in interest rate cuts, but it is also responding to the unwinding of carry trades that we've seen in the strength of the euro and of the yen. The euro has now just about unwound all of its overextension, and the question is whether it's going to rally very much beyond 111. I have my doubts about that. The Japanese yen has also been strengthening in here as carry trades have been unwound, and it represents a very large dynamic move in the market. I do think, though, we're going to have to see additional follow-through in order to really confirm it. But the Japanese market is feeling more pain than other markets for the simple reason that they have had to close all schools. They are trying very acutely to try and stamp out this infection now so they don't have to cancel the Olympics. So the second section index has pulled back extremely violently in here this week. It's been a reliable lead indicator for the wider Japanese market for as long as I can remember. And if it breaks on the downside, then the chances of the Nikkei holding the 20,000 level, I think, will be less convincing. When we look at the Nikkei, then it has been ranging above that 20,000 level for most of the last 2 years. 20,000 had been an area of resistance since approximately 1993. So the fact that it now represents support is an important, I think, argument towards the fact that this is a first step above the base. But of course, it needs to hold. When we look at the Europe Stoxx 600, it popped above 400 2 weeks ago. It has now pulled back below it. It is pulling back into the underlying range. It's testing the region of the trend mean. Now, a failed upside break, particularly when the dynamic of the failure is greater than the dynamic of the breakout, suggests that it will go right back down and test the lower side of the range. So if we don't get a significant bounce coming through next week, I think the likelihood is that the index is potentially going to come back down and test the lower side of the range, which is a lot closer to 340 than it is to 380. And that's an additional significant decline. So we definitely have had technical deterioration. We've definitely seen that currencies have come under pressure and that government bond yields have compressed. We have extremely oversold conditions, and the liquidity argument that has been one of the strongest rationales for owning stocks over the last decade is rapidly moving in favor of stocks. What we need to see is that that liquidity condition continues to expand. We do have some tacit evidence that that is starting now. The quantity of money sitting on global central banks has risen by about $300 billion over the course of the last week. And the reason for that is the weakness of the US dollar. The Federal Reserve has so far not been engaged in quantitative easing, but the weakness of the dollar is flattering the value of all other central bank totals. So we're back above the 20 trillion area, and I think that there is a clear potential that the quantity of money sitting on central banks' balance sheets is going to further expand. There is the real potential that we're going to see significant interest rate cuts right across the boards. The challenge with the coronavirus is to gain more knowledge about it and to, I think, compassionately look after the people that contract it. In China, they have been incredibly, I'm struggling to find an appropriate word, but they've been effective in trying to curtail the spread by getting rid of bodies, sometimes when those people have not in fact been dead. So that's, I think, one of the conditions that has helped them to try and get control over it. That is simply not going to fly in a democratic country. And every effort will be made to save as many lives as possible. That's one of the benefits of living in a democratic country. But it's also inordinately expensive, and it is going to require a significant effort on the behalf of everyone. There is obviously the potential that panic will ensue, and that we are going to see shortages evolve and runs on supermarkets. Obviously, that is something that is not a great or a desirable outcome, and it will have an effect on sentiment. So it's not like we're going to be bouncing back immediately from these lows. I think it is likely we're going to have some ranging, and we're very oversold in the short term. If this is a low of meaningful significance, even then we're likely to see a retest of the lows or a higher reaction low come in order to demonstrate a return to demand dominance. And we're not quite there yet. The thing that I am most alert to is liquidity conditions, the willingness of central banks to lend assistance, and joblessness. Because if the unemployment rate starts to trend higher, then that is something that is going to have a seriously deleterious effect on consumption and, by extension, the health of the services sector. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.